Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hello, we're back. Welcome to episode 54, would you believe it? No, hang on, I lied. It's episode 53 of Moments That Rock. I'm your host, Tony Michaelides. We're here every week delving into insider insights and hearing stories from a multitude of artists, behind the scenes, music industry people, and them telling their stories. Now, if you heard last week's podcast, and you should have done, it was with Mike Peters. Mike Peters, of course, the founder member of The Alarm, been around forever, still making records and still providing some amazing services around his country, Wales. We've got several parts of this, and I thought it'd be good to, normally I don't put them out week one and then the following week, part two. But I'm going to do it with this one because this is the story about something which certainly I haven't heard, and you probably haven't heard, but it's Mike Peters recounting what actually did happen at Red Rocks, because we interviewed Malcolm Gerry, who brought the production team over from Newcastle, from Tyne Tees Television, it was, in the northeast of England, to make that spectacular rock film, which everybody knows about, and actually was a good part to break in the band. You can hear Mike talk about that, but if you go back and listen to earlier episodes of this, there are four on YouTube, and one's with the gentleman himself, Malcolm Gerry. The others with Dave Robinson, the managing director, an interview I did with Adam and the Edge from 1984, another one with Bon and the Edge, so go check them out. Meanwhile, I shall shut up and we'll pass it over to Michael Peters.
London called Wasted Talent to try and get some gigs. And the secretary there was a girl called Sarah Jane Olson. And we told her we'd got this gig with The Fall at the agency. So she came to the gig hoping to say to us, I believe, "Look, I've been to see you now. You're no good. Stop hassling me."
Yeah.
but the opposite happened. We played the gig. She thought we were fantastic. And called us the next day and said, Ian Wilson, who represents you too, I'm his secretary. So he wants to come and see you, and will you play a gig at the Rock Garden that they'd organised for us overnight? And we went to play at the Rock Garden, which we could never get a gig at. So I don't know how they got us one in 24 hours, but they did. And we thought, this is it. And all of a sudden, you know what London was like at the time? If you got a smidge of a buzz going, everyone followed en masse. It was just like, we're going to see this band tonight. The phones would ring. Or they'd meet in the pub afterward and everyone would go to see the same gig. And all of a sudden, the Rock Garden was packed full of the entire London music industry, A&R community, overnight. And we went on stage and we were kind of aware that there was a buzz happening right in the venue. And we gave everything we got. We played our hearts out. And then we thought, this is it. We went in the dressing room. We thought, any minute, the music industry is going to come filing in through the door. And nothing happened. Not one, we were there for 20 minutes, 25 minutes. No one came in the dressing room until Sarah Jane opened the door about half an hour later, looked a bit, you know, sort of bedraggled and said, "Oh, that was great. Ian Wilson wants to meet you for breakfast tomorrow and talk about some more gigs." And be like, "Hooray, we made it," you know. And anyway, it turns out that the years later, Sarah Jane admitted to me that the whole industry was trying to bang the door down, but she was barricading the door. Said, "No, they're represented by Ian Wilson. There's no point coming in here."
Fantastic. And, love it.
Yeah, and we met with Ian the next day. And because we'd had sort of bad experience, we'd supported loads of bands at 17. And we got offered a gig at the last minute to go and open for Dexy's Midnight Runners at Huddersfield Town Hall. And the agent had said to us, "Look, if they like you, if Kevin Rowan likes you, you could get the whole tour, because the band that was supposed to be doing it have had to pull out for some reason." So we hightailed it up to Huddersfield Town Hall, jumped on stage, blasted out our set of 17. And then we thought, and then I saw Kevin Rowland after we came off stage. I said, "Kevin, what do you think?" He goes, "Oh, I didn't see you. I've only just walked in the door." I said, "But I tell you what, if you can play tomorrow night in Cardiff, I'll make sure I come in and see you. And if you're any good, you can come on tour with Dexy's Night Runners." So I thought, great, okay. So we went down to Cardiff. We gave it everything we got. Come off stage, there's Kevin Rowland. I said, "So what do you think, Kevin?" He goes, "Nah, you're rubbish, you're shite, you're not going to have the rest of the tour."
Really?
And I respected the honesty, you know, the direct. He didn't leave me, "Oh, I'll give you a ring, or I'll have my people speak to you, and then leave you dangling for months on end thinking, oh, when's the phone going to ring?" He was just straight up, and I admired that. As a result, when we met Ian Wilson this day after we played the Rock Garden, we one of our manifestos as a band was to Ian. We said, "Look, Ian, we really respect who you work for. We can see the roster you've got for Waste Talent. But one thing about The Alarm is we never, ever, ever want to support a band again for the rest of our lives, because you can book headline shows. We want to make it on our own terms. That's all we're ever going to do." He said, "Oh, I respect that. Well done, lad. You know, it's good to..." And we shook hands and said, "Right, let's carry on." And then we got home that afternoon after the breakfast meeting. The phone went. We were about to come home to Wales for Christmas. And it was Ian. He said, "Mike, I know we talked today and you never want to support them. There's a great opportunity come up tomorrow night to play with you two at the Lyceum Ballroom on the Strand. Do you want to do it?" You know, and I was like, "Well, hang on a minute. I'll talk to the others," and put my hand over the phone. Said, "It's Ian," you know, to the band. I said, "He wants us to play with you too, but we've got this manifesto. We're never going to support a band. What are we going to do?" And Eddie was going, "Yeah, I think we've got to stick to our guns," you know. And Dave's shaking his head, "Oh, yeah, I think it's a bit early to give up on our rules now." And Nigel Twist, the drummer, leaps over, grabs the phone, and goes, "Ian, of course we're going to play with you too tomorrow night."
This was around Boy, wasn't it?
The last night of the October tour in 1981.
Oh, I must have got it wrong. I seem to have thought you were out around the same time as Boy with you two, because there was yourselves, Concert Angels, maybe Simple Minds. There was a lot of acts around the same time.
We went to see, I first saw you two in the Marquee Club when they did a sort of Tuesday night residency, whatever the night was, early in the week. And I think I went to the first or second gig because it was about half full at the time. But by the time they'd done the fourth one, it was selling out everywhere. And but I remember seeing them, thinking how amazing they were. And I was in London when A Day Without Me came out. And I was a little bit disappointed in the record, to be honest, when I first heard it, because it wasn't as raw as it was when I'd seen them live. And I think that was for most fans who go and see potentially or future great bands and see them before they're recorded, there's always that lag of it doesn't quite live up to the expectation, because the recording studio, sort of, for young bands, they're not used to being in that environment. And of course, there's a sort of rawness to the recording, but it's not quite the same as when you've seen them live. And now I can appreciate the songs on Boy is a great album. But at the time, I was a bit, the production's, you know, what's all these sort of noises in the background? I just want to hear the guitar loud and this sort of thing. And again, that's just the naivety of not understanding the process. So I was quite aware of you two when we went to play with them, but it was the second night of the October tour. I'd been in Liverpool the night they played at the Royal Court Theatre on the October tour, but I hadn't gone to the gig. But I remember walking past the dressing room. I think I'd gone to, it might have been Brady's by then, see another gig by someone else. And I can remember seeing Pete Wiley outside talking to Bono by the stage door. And I kind of like waved at Pete Wiley as I went past. And I think Pete went in and sang some song with him on the end of the night or something like that. I seem to remember they might have done, they used to do Send in the Clouds or something like that. I can't remember. But here we, you know, we turned up. It was December 1981. It was the second night of the two they played at the Lyceum. U2 went sound checking because they'd played the night before. They'd gone to do some Christmas shopping. So we were setting up our equipment on the stage, and then I was putting my harmonicas out on my Roland JC120 amplifier. And then there was a tap on my shoulder. I looked around, and it was Bono himself introducing himself to me. And he was intrigued by my acoustic guitar with a pickup in it and harmonicas. He hadn't really come across the harmonicas, and I was saying, look, I can't really play guitar, and the Edge doesn't, you know, we don't have an acoustic guitar in U2. And I said, look, do you want me to show you some chords? And so he invited me back to the Portobello Hotel that night where they were staying. And off I went and sat down and showed Bono how to play Knocking on Heaven's Door, because that was the easiest song I could think of.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I interviewed, chit-chatted with Ian for Moments That Rock not too long ago. And they were representing U2 before they had a contract, weren't they? Because I remember going to see him. I think it might have just signed or just shortly after, because I saw him like four times in a week. I saw him play to a pub in Manchester to 11 people. But the previous Saturday, they were on at Manchester Polytechnic, which I think you've probably done yourself over the years. And they were third on the bill to Wahi and Pink Military. For some reason, I thought you were with U2 right from the beginning. So we must have met only 41 years ago, not 42 years ago.
I think we met for the first time in the December of 1982, we played that one show with U2 in December 81, and that was then they were going off to make a new album to write. I think Bono was went to Jamaica on holiday at Chris Blackwell's house or something, and then the Edge started Sunday Bloody Sunday, and I didn't hear from them. I went to the Portobello Hotel. We exchanged phone numbers, Bono and I. But, you know, I wasn't in the habit of picking it up and calling him at that point, you know. But we'd obviously struck up a friendship that night that was indelible in some ways. And a year later, almost, you know, 11 months later, through the Ian Wilson connection, because obviously Ian was their agent, he said to me, oh, look, U2 have finished their new album and they're going to go out and road test some songs before the new year. And they've got the single in on New Year's Eve, you know, New Year's Day came out on January the 1st, 1983. And they want you to be the opening act. And it was like, wow, amazing. You know, so we hightailed it up to Glasgow we played Tiffany's in Glasgow. That would have been the night we met. Yeah. And that was the first time they played New Year's Day and Sunday Bloody Sunday ever. And then the second night was Manchester Apollo, and you were definitely there, because on the bootleg of the gig, during one of the songs, Bono goes, all right, tone down.
I know, I wish I could never find that record. It's only on the front of the balcony or something, yeah.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. That was Manchester Apollo, that was 82.
Great, love it. What I love about this is picking up with old friends you haven't spoken to for a long, long time. As I said in there, I've known Mike for 40 plus years. And there were amazing times growing up, him learning his trade and me learning mine. You're listening to Moments That Rock with part two of Mike Peters. I'm your host, Tony Michaelides. If you want some other great music podcasts, then check out Pantheon Media, because there's 60 plus of them. We'll be back with Mike Peters telling us more of a story about a little show called Red Rocks.
The thing that I found interesting with you two was Bono was the ultimate hustler as well. Do you feel you learn even at that stage in your career by somebody like that who was so kind of, you know, determined to make everybody aware of the name of his band and who they were and everything?
Oh yeah, very much so. Yeah, you know, but I'd met and been around bands by then. You know, we played with the Stray Cats, who were ultimate sort of party band in a way, and met Kevin Rowland, and he was super serious. We played with the Clash, Buzzcocks, you know, Pink Military. You mentioned earlier, did play with them. Played with the Fall. You know, but by the time we played with U2, we played with the Jam at Deeside Leisure Centre. We played with the Beat. We played at Flock of Seagulls. We'd Boomtown Rats. We'd supported them, and that, a lot of that was through Ian Wilson. And we saw how different bands operated and di how different singers approached the role of being singer or lead, you know, or sometimes the leader of the band wasn't the singer like we always perceived, you know, it could be somebody different. And so when I met Bono, he just seemed to that a bit more committed than anyone else I'd met in music before. He could be fun, but he was deadly serious about what he was doing. And what I admired about U2 was when they finished the gig and came off stage, they immediately started thinking about tomorrow and the next gig. And that was what they wanted to protect. They didn't
Not only that,
necessarily.
Mike, they would always come out and meet everybody at the end of the gig, you know, because that Pink
That's
Military
it.
gig, there was probably like 150 there, but kind of 120 of them were by the bar. So you just had a huddle
Yeah.
of people and then they came out. I often think what Bono would be like on social media now after a gig. They didn't have all those things in those days to reach out to fans.
No,
You had
not
to
at
kind of
all.
interact with them, you know. Yeah, that. But that's what I liked, because the real bands, without sounding like a boring old fart, you know, going back to the days of Zeppelin, the Floyd, they just played their asses off, and you did the same. You just went back and forth to America, played every small venue, worked your way up. Now, here's another question for you, Mr. Peters, with my investigative journalism stuff here. There's a few people, like I said, that when I sent you the note, there's a lot of the, you know, usual suspects in there that you'll know. Malcolm Gerry, I interviewed a while back for this. Obviously, he put together the crew that came over and did Under a Blood Red Sky, sorry, Live at Red Rocks. And I found out that you, because of the weather and the danger, you turned down the support on that.
We didn't turn it down. We were there,
Oh,
you
you were
know.
there, but you
We,
just didn't play.
yeah, Malcolm Geary got that wrong. I think he says we turned down
Oh, maybe I
the.
read it then. Maybe don't, let's not blame Malcolm. Maybe I got it wrong.
No, there's some a few factual things are supposed to be out there about the alarm at Red Rocks that aren't true. But we what the reality of the day was we were on the whole tour, well, that from San Francisco onwards to the end of the war tour. And when we got to Red Rocks, obviously U2 had put their lives on the line. They
Oh,
invested their
yeah.
own money in the production. They wanted to they brought Malcolm Geary, the ITV crew, over from Tyne Tees, I think they were probably at the time, from the Tube. And they were all there when we got to the gig. The weather was horrific, and U2 had brought Steve Lillywhite was there, Jimmy Iovine. They were all backstage because they wanted to record the gig. Paul McGinnis had you know used all his film know-how to make it a spectacular event. The I know the Beatles had played at Red Rocks, but it wasn't a world-renowned venue. It wasn't known around the world like it is now. But even though it's got a long history with rock and roll, but U2 realized with Paul McGinnis the potential of playing there, how spectacular that would look, and so they want to get it absolutely right. And when the day arrived, it was, I mean, it was June. It was incredible. You wouldn't have thought that the weather could be that bad in the summer in America, in especially in Colorado, but it was. You know, they had everything on their side apart from the weather. It was dreadful. And with Red Rocks, when you go to the venue itself, it's a public space till 4 o'clock. So even though you say setting up the equipment at 12 o'clock, people still come into the venue and walk up the stairs. And often people use the steps of the venue to do their training, and they're jogging up and down and doing all sorts of things. And then at 4 o'clock, they close it off completely while the band do the sound check.
Yeah.
Now, on this particular day in history, it was so bad the weather, there wasn't many people there, and the organizers and the promoters actually called the gig off. And there's a free concert arranged for the next day at Boulder, right, Colorado, yeah, University. And on the day, you two were disappointed. We've got some great photographs as well backstage, and you can see Edge and Larry all looking at the screen of the weather reports, looking all pensive because they've obviously put a lot onto it. And on the war tour itself, you two always had a red carpet on the stage to perform upon, which enhanced the drama of the white flag at the back of the stage and the boy logo and everything, and with the cut lip. And our roadies, Gaz and Red Eye, were detailed to start painting. Every time there was a break in the weather, they went out with red paint and painted the stage bright red. And then the wind and the rain would come again, lift all the paint off the floor and throw it against all the tarpaulins they had all over the equipment. It was that bad. And then eventually they called the gig off and put the notification out on the radio that the gig was going to be called off. And but because, again, Red Rocks is a public space, people still started turning up, and not everyone got the message that a gig was out. But because it hadn't been turned into an official gig, you could still walk right up and stand in front of the stage. And what was decided backstage was, they first of all, everyone came and said, look, you can't play tonight. The alarm aren't going to play, but we did the next night as well. But Bono came up to me and said, look, what we're going to do is we're going to go on stage and play one song to get some outdoor footage. And the plan was, with Pete Williams, their lighting designer, and everyone else, Malcolm Geary, that they would film the Boulder, Colorado gig as an indoor show, which is a basketball arena, which is still a big venue. And then they were going to cut a few shots from the outdoor at Red Rocks in to enhance the footage that they were going to shoot properly the next day. So Bono said, we're going to go on and play Out of Control, or whatever it was that they were opening with, and then we'll do one other song and you can come out and play, and we're going to do Hard Rain's Gonna Fall by Bob Dylan in the rain. We're like, okay, great idea, let's do it. That's all set up. So you two then go out on stage, it's cameras roll, everything's ready to go, and literally, as they walked on stage, it was like a bit of a mini miracle happened in the first minute. It was almost like the weather shifted instantly, and the rain just stopped. And I remember being at the side of the stage and Paul McGuinness coming up from down below and urging the crew, get messages out, keep going. They got hold of Adam first, I think, said, get a message to Bono, keep the show going, play. The cameras were rolling. As everything was going, tape was recording because they were only going to do one song and capture it anyway. And a lot of the drama in the footage, the burnout of the camera, which enhances the gig in the long term, that was that because no one had really calibrated the cameras properly because of the weather. So everything was all up in the air. When you see the final recording of Under Blood Red Sky, the LP itself, or the EP, the mini LP that they released, the songs are from Germany. They're not, there's only one recording from Under Blood Red Sky concert on the actual soundtrack album. That's because they hadn't time to really calibrate the recording levels. So a lot of it was, when you see it with the pictures, you get away with the sound. But if you just listen to it, it's quite raw, as it wasn't really captured as well as they would have hoped for Steve Lillywhite and Jimmy Iovine.
Dennis, the tour manager, I mean, he was working with the Stone the Crows at the time when Les Harvey got electrocuted. And with Bono doing all his walkabouts and climbing the stuff, it's like Malcolm Geary said to me, the actual weather and the way it broke, and you could see, you know, the steam coming out of his mouth and all this and everything. No filter could have done that. Like a Viet Cong pilot flying upside down in a helicopter on the stage, taking all these amazing images, the rocks and stuff. So it was a pretty incredible thing. And of course, it became like a great, you know, moment in rock history, so to speak.
Absolutely. When they finished the gig and they came off stage, Bono said to me, come on, Mike, still going to do Hard Rain's Going to Fall.
Oh, get ready, no.
Come on. And then Paul McGuinness comes and goes, look, Mike, I'm sorry, but I know Bono wants to go, but this summit history is happening here tonight, so you're going to have to stand down till tomorrow night. But if you look back at the film, when they come out for the encore, do 40, the Edge is actually playing. He swapped guitars with Adam, but he picks up my guitar.
Oh, does he? Of,
great. It's all set up for me to go on and play with him. So that's it. And then we did play the next night at Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
And we did do Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. It was pretty dreadful because none of us had actually learned how to play the song. We all thought it was one though we knew it inside out. But when we get on stage, like, how's it actually go? So Bono ended up sacking all of us, the you two and the Alarm, and I think he finished it a cappella on his own.
Excellent. Lead singer, founder from the Alarm, Mike Peters, in part two of his little soiree with me. You have been listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides. We're part of the Pantheon group of podcasts where you can hear endless, wonderful music-related music podcasts. We'll be back with part three of Mike. We'll leave that for a few weeks. We'll have a new guest next week. Thanks for listening. Subscribe, tell all your friends, and come back and listen again. See you next week.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.